actor who was resisting a French tax increase. NPR's Corey Flintoff says it's not clear whether actor Gerard Depardieu has any plans to take up residence in Russia.
A Russian government website said that Putin signed the grant of citizenship, but it gave no details, including whether or not Depardieu had ever formally requested Russian nationality. Last month, there were reports that the French actor had said he was considering applying for a Russian passport. Putin said at the time that he felt sympathy for Depardieu, who's resisting a French tax proposal that would boost his rate from 41% to 75%. Russia has a flat income tax rate of 13%. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Paramount Vantage and Indian Paintbrush, presenting Not Fade Away, written and directed by David Chase, now playing in select theaters everywhere Friday.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
Happy New Year and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Today's show is a rebroadcast of a conversation from October of last year. I spoke with journalist and author Paul Tough about early childhood education. Tough has written a couple of books on the subject. One was called Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. His more recent book, on which some of our conversation was based, is called How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Tough has spent more than a quarter century in journalism, some of it in public radio. He was one of the original editors of This American Life. But most of the way, his focus has been on the intersection of education, poverty, and politics. A reminder that as today's program is pre-recorded, you will not be able to call in. However, I welcome any feedback you might have about today's show and the issues surrounding early childhood education. You can post those comments on our website on today's Focus post at will.illinois.edu/focus or visit our Facebook page. We're at Will Radio TV Online. You can tweet us at Will Public Media or shoot us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And enjoy the show. Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Back in 1994, the Carnegie Corporation published a report raising concerns about the cognitive development of American children. It was titled Starting Points, Meeting the Needs of Our Youngest Children. It suggested the increase in single-parent families and working mothers was leading to children no longer getting enough cognitive stimulation in the first 3 years of life, so they weren't ready for kindergarten. That report helped spawn an industry of products. The Baby Einstein series may come to mind. These ostensibly educational products are intended to help children in the first 3 years of life to get a head start and be ready for kindergarten and beyond. Journalist Paul Tough argues for a somewhat different approach, a character-based learning approach. He says success for children has less to do with how much information they take in during their early years or even their IQ, and more to do with their ability to learn and demonstrate certain character traits, ranging from grit and curiosity to conscientiousness and optimism. Today on the program, we'll explore the latest theories about early childhood education with Paul Tough. He walks through his conclusions and shares examples of what he means in his new book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. In the book, he attempts to connect the dots between neuroscience research, economics, and psychology to show how these qualities of character impact a child's success. Paul Tough, welcome to Focus.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Paul, how did this notion of cognitive early childhood development first sort of catch on?
Well, I think you're right in identifying that Carnegie Corporation report as part of the beginning of this trend. I mean, one thing I should say off the top is that one way of looking at the history of American education is this pendulum, you know, that we've gone back and forth between emphasizing character and emphasizing intelligence. But I think over the last 20 years, the pendulum has swung about as far as possible towards the intelligence side of things. I think that partly had to do with that report, which I think people overinterpreted as being all about, you know, needing to teach kids to read when they were two and three and getting them to do, you know, math homework before they even started kindergarten. But at the same time, I think there have been these legislative changes that happened in education over the last 10 or 12 years, including No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, which have changed the education system to be more and more focused on standardized tests, which measure a pretty narrow range of cognitive skills. So that has pushed teachers and principals and school systems toward emphasizing those skills as well.
Has it also, in your view, impacted then early childhood education, those first 3 years before someone enters the school system?
It has, yes. And so, you know, I think there are some great early childhood education programs out there, and a lot of them, I think, take a more balanced approach. But I think that it has led to this rise in organizations like Junior Kumon and Fast Track Kids, and this anxiety that I think a lot of parents feel that early childhood is this race, that it's not about sort of developing kids in any sort of holistic sense. It's about this one narrow set of skills. It's about their cognitive skills. And if they are not ahead of all the other kids in class by the time they hit kindergarten, they're doomed.
You write this, and this is the quote, conventional wisdom about child development over the past few decades has been misguided. How is it misguided?
Well, I think it's because we've focused so much on this narrow range of cognitive skills. And if you look at the evidence in terms of what helps kids not just on next week's test, but in terms of the long-term outcomes we care about, both in terms of education, things like graduating from college, and beyond that, in terms of life success, there are lots of indications that it is this other set of skills, these non-cognitive skills or character strengths, that actually make at least as much of a difference as IQ does, and arguably much more of a difference.
So what do you mean by character-based learning? How do you build character, and what character traits are you talking about?
Well, I'll take the second part of your question first because it's easier to answer.
All right.
So the kind of character traits that these scientists and educators are focused on include things like grit and curiosity, perseverance, conscientiousness, optimism. So it's a range of different skills. Part of the complication about writing about this, they're trying to turn this into some kind of educational program, is that these different disciplines all have different terms for this. So economists call these non-cognitive skills. Educators often call them character strengths. Psychologists call them personality traits. And the other complication is that we don't know exactly how to teach these things. One thing we do know is that early childhood is very important, but what's most important in early childhood is not drilling with worksheets and tests and trying to get kids to develop their cognitive ability as quickly as possible. It's about stress and their relationship with parents and other adults, that when kids are able to develop in those first couple of years emotionally and psychologically and socially, that makes a huge difference, not only in terms of their kind of psychological well-being going forward, but also in their later cognitive development, that kids who enter kindergarten with the ability, say, to regulate their emotions and regulate their thoughts with this skill of self-regulation, they're going to be better prepared for learning. They're going to be able to sit still. They're going to be able to focus in class. They're going to be able to take in contradictory information. And the way that we prepare kids for that is again, not to make them, you know, anxious and crazy with homework early on. It's by protecting them from stress, by giving them emotional support, by having close attachment with a parent or another caregiver. So in this way that I think can sometimes seem contradictory, the outcomes that these scientists and educators care about are these pretty, you know, narrow, specific, making more money, graduating from college kind of markers. But the steps that need to happen in a child's life in order to help them develop these skills often have more to do with emotions and psychology than they do with cognitive development.
You've mentioned stress a couple of times. What impact exactly does stress have on a child's ability to learn?
Well, stress is a big deal, and this was something before I started this reporting that I didn't really realize. You know, we know that there is a whole lot going on, especially in the early years of a child's life, a lot of systems being developed. But one of the most important ones, and one of the ones that I think until recently was least well understood, is the development of the stress response system. And every infant goes through stress. Babies get scared or hungry or lonely, and they cry, and then they are soothed and calmed down. And that process for most kids is a positive one. It's, you know, the stress response system in some way is like a muscle, so you need to exercise it a little bit in early childhood in order to develop it. But for kids who are surrounded in their early years by intense and chronic stress, what doctors sometimes call toxic stress, this is not a positive process at all. It doesn't build up their stress response system. In fact, it debilitates it. It weakens it. And for kids who experience that kind of toxic stress early on, the effect on their stress response system can last a lifetime. It can make them make it certainly difficult for them to deal with stress and conflict and confusion later in life. But it has much more far-ranging effects as well. It affects their physical health, even into adulthood. It affects their mental health, and it also affects the development of this set of skills called executive functions that matter a whole lot in school, starting on the first day of kindergarten.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is journalist Paul Tough. You may recognize the name and the voice from his contributions to the public radio series This American Life. He helped Ira Glass create the show. He's also edited the program for a while. He's also written articles in the New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker, and his newest book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. And that's what we're talking about with him this morning. We welcome your questions and comments about early childhood education and some of the theories out there about how to best prepare young children and what they ought to learn in the first years of life. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's get back to these character traits a little bit. How do educators come up with those terms? And why those specific traits?
Well, different educators emphasize different traits. The list that I gave is one that doesn't come so much from educators, but comes more from psychologists and economists, that as they over the past couple of decades have tried to trace which skills in early childhood correlate with success later on. These are some of the ones that they've come up with. Self-control, conscientiousness, optimism. We have especially good evidence around those ones that when kids have those abilities early on in life, it pays off for them later on. There's this famous marshmallow test that a psychologist named Walter Mischel came up with, where in the late 60s he gave a bunch of four-year-olds this test to see how long they could wait for a marshmallow without grabbing it and eating it. And the kids who were able to delay gratification the longest to exercise that self-control as four-year-olds did better in adulthood on all kinds of measures.
But it depends, doesn't it, on whether there are other kids around and whether they're grabbing for the marshmallows?
It does, it does. So the marshmallow experiment was this very sort of carefully controlled sort of psychological torture,
right,
where they took kids into a room and they would sit each child down individually. A researcher was there with them, and they would put one marshmallow in front of them, and they'd say, if you want to eat this marshmallow, you just have to ring the bell, and I'll come back in and give it to you. But if you can wait until I come back on my own, I'll give you two marshmallows. And so that was the test to see how long kids could survive staring at a marshmallow without eating it or ringing the bell to bring the researcher back in.
All right, so that explains the self-control part. But what about some of these other traits? How do you teach optimism?
Well, there's this whole field of psychology that's closely related to this character research that's called positive psychology. And some of the most important researchers who I read about come out of this tradition of positive psychology. It is the creation 30 or so years ago of this one psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania named Martin Seligman, along with a few other colleagues. And Martin Seligman has written for a while about things like learned helplessness and learned optimism. And he makes a pretty convincing case in his books that that optimism is something that can be taught to kids and to adults. And he's not talking about this sort of naive, pie-in-the-sky, Pollyannish, everything's going to be great. But he talks about the explanatory style that kids have and that adults have. And I think we all sort of recognize this in ourselves and those around us, that there are certain people when they get bad news, when they experience a setback, who interpret it as being something that is, you know, a sign of their own weakness, as being just terrible news that's never going to change, and then others who can take that bad news and reframe it in a more positive way, like, okay, this is a small setback. It's not doesn't really say anything about my self-worth. I can try again. And the people who have that more optimistic outlook toward failure and toward setback do better in all kinds of ways. And Seligman and others make this pretty strong case that kids can learn this, especially in adolescence. Kids are able to really recognize these patterns in themselves, and with help from certainly from a psychologist, but even from a parent, a teacher, a mentor of some kind, they can learn how to reframe events and be more take a more positive outlook, and that means they'll do better with setbacks later on.
You mentioned that some of these traits come from psychologists, and you also mentioned in some cases from economists. And one of the folks you cite as sort of being at the lead of this character-based approach is an economist at the University of Chicago, James Heckman. What does he have to say about character within young children, and what's an economist doing worrying about that?
It's a good question. So Heckman is one of the main characters in the book, and certainly for me in my reporting, he was central. He helped me understand a lot of this stuff early on, partly because I think he himself has done such important work, and partly because he is, you know, people in these different fields tend to get stuck in their own disciplines, and psychologists only talk to psychologists, and economists only talk to economists. And Heckman is someone who realized that there was a whole lot that psychology could do to help inform what he was finding in economics, so he made a lot of these connections. And so Heckman doesn't talk about character very often. He talks about non-cognitive skills. That's the economist term for this stuff. And he, back in the late 1990s, did a couple of experiments, a couple of studies that puzzled him. So because economists have always, you know, believed that it's intelligence, it's IQ, that is the biggest predictor of kids' success. But he did this one big study about the GED, especially, in which he discovered that the difference between GED holders and high school graduates was not their intelligence, that they were all about equally intelligent. But there was this huge difference in terms of how well they did in life. The GED is supposed to demonstrate, you know, that you have all the same skills as a high school graduate. But in fact, if you look at what happens to GED holders and what happens to high school graduates, they do very differently. High school graduates do much better in terms of their path through life. And so he came to believe that there was this separate set of skills, these other skills that high school graduates had that weren't about intelligence, that weren't about what they'd actually learned in high school, but were just about the ability to persevere through high school, to put up with all the pain in the neck that high school can sometimes be. And the people who were able to do that, who had these non-cognitive skills, did better in all sorts of ways. So that was what started Heckman toward this idea of trying to name these skills, identify them, demonstrate their connection with long-term success, and then eventually to try to figure out how to develop them in kids.
And you've sort of led us to another point of your book, which is citing examples of how this concept manifests itself in various high schools, in various school systems around the country, in various students. And I want to get to that in just a minute. But a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Paul Tough. He's a journalist and author, and his latest book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. In it, he questions the cognitive approaches to early childhood learning that became popular in the 1990s and have largely persisted since. He talks about a character-based approach to learning and its value, in particular in the first years of a child's life. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on WILO's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we have an email question. Listener asks, how much, in your opinion, does a child's innate personality affect his or her ability to learn, in particular those executive skills that you spoke of earlier?
I would say that they matter a whole lot, but I would also argue that they're not all that innate. So I think this is one of the complications of this research, and especially about using terms like character. I think a lot of us believe that character strengths are something that are innate, that we just get at birth, and that there's not a whole lot that anyone can do to help kids develop them. But in fact, the evidence points in a very different direction, that these skills are very much formed by the environment in which a child grows up, and that even into adolescence, they're still malleable. They're still able to be influenced by the environment around kids, and especially by the relationships that they have with adults. So whether it's a teacher or a family member or a coach or a mentor of some kind, when we can help kids, even into adulthood, develop these personality traits, these character strengths, they can absolutely change them. And then it makes a huge difference in terms of how kids are able to learn and how well they're able to do.
So let's drill down to some examples. Throughout your book, you cite examples of schools and students who in some way demonstrate why you believe character-based learning is as or more important than cognitive-based learning. Let's start with one, Christian Fenger High School in Chicago. What have you learned from that school?
So Fenger High School is on the south side. It is in a real difficult, high-poverty neighborhood, and it is a school that has been not doing well for a long time. The records go back about 20 years, and for all those 20 years, their dropout rate has been high and their achievement rate has been low. So I spent a couple of years, over the last few years, reporting at Fenger, and the reason I was there was because of this project that they had taken on with a program called the Youth Advocate, Youth Advocate Programs. It's a mentorship program that Ron Huberman, when he was the head of the schools in Chicago, introduced to try to help the most at-risk kids in all of the city. They identified the 250 kids who were most likely to be victims of violence. And as you know, in Chicago these days, especially in certain neighborhoods, there is a whole lot of violence and a lot of it taking place with young kids. And so this program was designed to do this intensive mentoring, as many as 16 hours a day spent with kids, to try to give them exactly the kind of support that I'm talking about, that close connection with a mentor that could enable them to undergo the kind of transformation that they needed to undergo in order to graduate from high school and move on with life. And these were kids who had, you know, in the first 15 or so years of their life, dealt with really significant difficulties, very chaotic families for the most part, very difficult environments, and it had this huge effect on them. They were, you know, they were certainly having trouble in school, but most of them were also, you know, depressed, anxious, so often sort of overwhelmed by this trauma. And a lot of them did not do well in the program. A lot of them were so damaged that it was difficult for them to bounce back. But there were some who I write about who really turned things around in a pretty significant way, including some of the students at Fenger. And so to me, that was an example of, you know, obviously this isn't the ideal way to help kids, to wait until they're 15 and have undergone all those years of difficult circumstances and then try to help them. But it was an indication that even at that age, and even with kids who have withstood all kinds of difficulty early on, it's not too late to really give them the kind of support that enables them to transform their lives in a significant way.
Let's put a finer point on this notion of difficult circumstances. We talked earlier about the impact that stress can have on a child and a child's development in terms of education. What effect does poverty have on a child's education?
Well, it's a complicated question because I don't think that poverty itself necessarily has an effect on kids. And one of the things that I think is important in this new research is that rather than just say, you know, look at poverty as just this vague force out there that makes kids' lives worse, these researchers are able to drill down into poverty and identify the specific elements, the specific factors in the life of a low-income child, a child growing up in a low-income family, that makes things so difficult. I think the two, there are lots of them, but I think the two most important ones are stress. So when kids grow up surrounded by a lot of toxic stress, which does often go along with poverty, though it's not true in the lives of every poor kid, that has a really negative effect on them. And then the other is their level of connection with an adult, and a parent, or another caregiver. One of the things that I found most remarkable in this research is that when kids are able to have that close, connected, attached relationship with a parent or another caregiver early in life, the effects of toxic stress are diminished in a really significant way. So the kids can grow up in really difficult circumstances, but if they have that strong relationship with an adult who sort of serves as a protective force, they are so much more likely to do really well.
We're talking with journalist Paul Tough about his latest book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. And we'll take your phone calls and some more emails after a short break. This is Focus.
The largest al-Qaeda-held territory in the world is in northern Mali, where Islamic extremists seized control in April and are terrifying the population by performing amputations as punishments. Islamic extremists now have a sanctuary there. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Adam Nossiter, the New York Times West Africa Bureau Chief. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by the Regent Ballroom. Winter dance classes start in January with classes in beginners, ballroom, swing, and jazz. The complete class schedule is at regentballroom.com. Dancing is not just for the stars.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with journalist Paul Tough. In his new book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character, he seeks to connect the dots between neuroscience research, economics, and psychology to show how certain qualities of character impact a child's success. What do you think? Is it more important to teach cognitive skills to children in their first years of life, or to try to impart lessons that develop key character traits? Or is it just enough to make sure kids in those first years learn to walk, talk, and eat? Paul, we've talked about an economist, and we talked about what psychologists are saying. What about neuroscience? What neuroscience research tells us something about early childhood development?
Well, neuroscience underpins a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of the stress, especially. The researchers who have discovered the most about how stress impacts kids are neuroscientists. And they're also the ones who have done research showing how important that close relationship with a parent or another caregiver can be in order, in terms of protecting kids from that stress. And so we've learned a whole lot more about how the brain develops and how the stress response to the system develops, and it's mostly through the work of those neuroscientists.
We started talking about some of the schools and students that you have talk about in the book. Let's talk about another one. What's the KIPP Academy, and what can be learned from it?
Sure. So KIPP is a nationwide network of charter schools. I think there are about 125 schools now across the country. And I mostly spent time reporting at the KIPP schools in New York City, and particularly in one school in West Harlem called KIPP Infinity. And the KIPP charter schools mostly serve low-income kids, and that's certainly true of this school in West Harlem. And KIPP has got a national reputation of doing a really great job of boosting kids' test scores. In New York and other places, their test scores are usually much higher than they are in these high-poverty neighborhoods where the kids come from. And the KIPP Academy was the first KIPP school in New York. It was run by one of the two founders of KIPP, this man named Dave Levin. And when KIPP Academy's first class got to eighth grade, they took this statewide standardized test in New York, and they had some of the best test scores, the fifth highest test scores in all of New York City, the highest test scores in the Bronx. And so everyone was expecting that group of kids to go on and do fantastically well. The goal for them was for all of them to graduate from college. But as they went on through high school and then into and through college, they didn't do so well. A lot of them dropped out, and in fact only 21% of that first cohort has graduated from a four-year college so far. And so for Dave Levin and for other people at KIPP, that was a real disappointment and a real wake-up call. And I think the first indication for them that simply focusing as much as they had been on these cognitive skills, developing the kind of abilities that showed up on an eighth-grade standardized test, was not enough. That if you wanted to help, especially low-income kids without a lot of family resources, if you wanted to help them get through college, achieve a four-year BA, they needed other character strengths. They needed the ability to persevere at a difficult task, to bounce back from disappointment, to overcome the kind of obstacles that happen all the time in college. And in fact, they need those skills much more so than kids who were growing up in affluence or even in the middle class, because for those kids, they had the family resources. They had, you know, quite literally the money sometimes to cushion those blows when they came in college. These kids didn't have that luxury, and so they needed these character strengths in order to compensate for that. And so Kip has spent the last few years working on this big project to try to figure out how best to develop these strengths in kids.
We have an email from Ron who asks how your viewpoint is like and different from William J. Bennett's outlook.
So Bennett is focused on virtues, I believe. I have it right that's the term that he likes using. And so he talks a lot about character as well, but he talks about it in terms of kids and their virtues. And in some ways, you know, this is another one of the complications of using the term character, that I think for a lot of us, we think of it in this moral, ethical dimension. And I think there's you know, I think morals and ethics are important, but I think there are some real drawbacks to looking at these skills through that lens, because I think that parents and kids rightfully can react negatively to that idea, to someone, you know, in their school coming in lecturing to them about what values they have. And you know, I think what is often implicit in that is that their values are wrong and someone else's values are right. And so what is interesting to me about this new generation of educators who are trying to develop character in their students, including those the folks at KIPP I was just talking about, is that they are trying to do it without reference to particular values or ethical, moral questions. Instead, they're identifying character strengths as this set of skills that are simply about making kids effective. You know, perseverance doesn't really have a moral dimension, or it shouldn't have a moral dimension. It's simply about having the inner strength, having the non-cognitive skill to bounce back from setbacks. And what we know is that that is something that can be taught and learned. And I think when kids and parents are presented with an idea of character education that exists in that dimension, they are much more receptive to it, especially, you know, this is sort of what schools do, right? Schools are all about giving kids the skills they need to succeed. But in the past, we have thought that those skills were just the cognitive skills that get taught in the classroom regularly. What KIPP and other schools are showing is that, in fact, there are other skills that are needed for kids to do well. And so they are trying to expand the universe of skills that they're teaching kids to include these other skills that, that now evidence is suggesting are so important for things like college success.
There's a quote in your book that sort of underlies this notion of a separation between the character-driven approach you talk about and a values and ethics approach. A gentleman named David Levin, who says, quote, "The inevitable problem with the value and ethics approach is you get into, well, whose values, whose ethics?"
Exactly right, yeah. And it's Dave Levin who was the founder of KIPP, and so that's exactly what he's thinking about as he's trying to develop this new set of skills for kids there.
Let's take a call. We have Ken on the line from Champaign. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Probably without saying, certainly on the low income and all that kind of stuff is nutrition. You know, I mean, that's probably without saying, I would assume, right? I mean, a big problem in terms of these children.
Yeah, I think nutrition is, you know, is definitely an issue. I think the reality is, and this is what I meant when I was talking about, you know, how it's useful that we're breaking down the question of poverty into its different elements.
Yeah.
You know, I think part of what is so complicated about trying to help poor kids do better, about trying to improve environments for poor kids, is that there are so many disadvantages that they often face at the same time, especially kids who are growing up in the kind of high poverty neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago, where I did a lot of my reporting. So yes, they have poor nutrition. They also have a lot of crime in their neighborhoods. They also are less likely to be living in two-parent families. They also have schools that aren't very good. And the combination of all those things we know takes a tremendous toll on them and leads to negative outcomes. So
yeah,
these researchers are trying to do now is figure out exactly which of those matter the most.
Yeah, actually the major one is that years ago, and especially in the business community, they talked about, and how does this differ, emotional intelligence. Do you remember that a while back when that
yeah.
was, So is these some of the same dimensions? I don't recall what they talked about, but it would seem that there'd be some overlap and that this was more important than, you know, IQ. So anyway, any comment there? And I'll just go off the line here. And thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Sure. Thanks for the call. So yeah, I think there's some overlap, but I think these are two pretty distinct ideas. My understanding or recollection of emotional intelligence is that it was mostly about interpersonal relationships. It was about how we get along with each other, and that's certainly an important element, I think, to success. But these character strengths that Kip and other schools are emphasizing, and that these researchers are telling us are important, are more internal. They're more about things like overcoming setbacks, persevering despite difficulties. And that, you know, often involves others, but it's not just about the kind of emotional connection with others. It's also just about our own way, our own sort of psychological dimension of how we deal with the world around us and think about the world around us.
Let's go next to caller in Mattoon. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. My name is Ann, and I'm an early childhood educator. I happen to have the day off, and I'm thrilled that I caught your show today, and I can't wait to get my hands on Paul's book. I just have a couple of comments. Certainly nutrition is a huge thing. I think as researchers and higher education focuses on maybe different aspects like, you know, cognitive and things, those of us who are out there in the field are constantly working to develop all aspects of our children and know how much different things interact with each other. I mean, you know, if you have a child who is, say, their parents are going through a divorce and they are eating donuts every morning, they are not going to be able to concentrate on developing cognitive. They're not going to be learning sight words that day, you know. And all the systems work together, physical, emotional, cognitive, and it's something that those of us in the field are constantly trying to keep in balance. And I just wanted to mention, I'm in early childhood. My husband is an economics professor at a university, and he has noticed his, you know, the primary group of students that he's been working with lately were very young children in the early 90s. And he has noticed that maybe there was an emphasis on cognitive in their early childhood years. However, he has noticed much less ability to problem solve and think on their own. He says, you know, most of the kids coming through the system just expect to regurgitate ideas that are thrown at them in the classroom. And he has very much a problem-solving approach. And he said it's very difficult for a lot of the students who have never really been taught to think. So those are just a couple of my comments. And if I could just use this forum real quickly to say, parents, when you pick up your child from preschool or daycare or school, get off of your cell phone and concentrate on your child for those precious few minutes. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Paul, any reaction?
That was a great call. I appreciated all of her comments. I think to just talk briefly about her first comment, I think she's right that there are all sorts of teachers, especially early childhood teachers, but I think lots of teachers who know instinctively that teaching and child development is and should be a balance between these different skills. But I think, you know, to go to her second point about what her husband is experiencing, I think for the past 15 years or so in this country, we have emphasize these cognitive skills so much in our education system and given incentives to teachers, to principals, to school systems to put all of their emphasis on the kind of skills that get measured on these cognitive tests. And I think the effect that lots of people are seeing, and I think the caller's husband sounds like he's one of them, is that it has narrowed the range of abilities that these kids have, that we have lots of kids in college now who are, you know, were maybe great test takers, but are lacking that kind of deeper thinking skills and character strengths that enable them to deal with the kind of complicated information and situations that college is throwing at them every day.
Getting back to her first comment, is it strictly about balance, or, you know, you write that different personality types respond to different motivations. Doesn't that suggest that some children are more likely to respond to cognitive learning while others respond to character-driven learning that really needs to be customized to the child?
I'm not sure if I would agree with that. I mean, so I do think that different personality types, you're right, do respond differently to motivation. But in terms of what kind of education they get, I think every child needs a balance between these two different approaches. And my sense is just that in the past, 10 or 20 years, the pendulum has swung too far. We have moved in early childhood and in later school years toward emphasizing only those cognitive skills. And that what we need is to go back to a much more balanced approach for every kid.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there is still time for your questions and comments for journalist Paul Tough, author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Steve in Champaign. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. Enjoying the conversation. I joined it rather late, so if this has been covered, I apologize. Your guest was talking about schools. I grew up in the south side of Chicago, and about violence and such, and I was wondering maybe if your guest could talk about the import of coming, this probably seems a little obvious, but coming from a stable home environment, maybe with two parents, where I'm going with this is so many of our neighborhoods now, I believe the out-of-wedlock rate is something approaching 80%, and I don't see how you can break that cycle of violence in schools or poor performance in schools if you have a child who's coming from a bad home environment. And what I'm noticing is, again, pretty obvious, but the huge dichotomy between those people who are successful and those people aren't. And in this day and age, I mean, if you're dropping out of high school, your chances of success, to me, are almost impossible, where you're going to be turning into maybe crimes and violence. So I was wondering maybe if your guest could, if he hasn't already, maybe speak to that, because what I'm noticing are children at a very young age punching out, dropping out, giving up hope, looking at their futures and looking rather bleak, and I think that's a dangerous scenario. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. Paul, he covers a lot of ground there, but one of the things that he does refer to there at the end is, again, a question of a character trait and the importance of you teach optimism. Maybe they're more optimistic about their education and the role it could play in their lives as they go along through school.
Yeah, so I mean, to talk more broadly about his point, I think he's absolutely right that in a lot of the neighborhoods, so I mostly reported in this neighborhood called Roseland on the south side of Chicago, very high poverty neighborhood, not doing well by all kinds of measures, and I think he's right that a big part of the problem for kids there is about the environment that they're growing up in. I don't think that it's true that kids need two parents in order to succeed. I think there are lots of examples of kids who are raised by one parent and go on to, say, become president of the United States or something like that. But I do think that it's absolutely true that over the last several decades, but especially over the last 20 years, that there has been this division between wealthier Americans and less wealthy Americans in terms of how stable families are, and the divorce rate and the divorce rate has gone down and the marriage rate has gone up for high income Americans, and among low income Americans the opposite has happened. So we have this huge divide that I think we don't talk about very often in terms of how these different classes are doing in terms of family stability, and we know that it makes a huge difference in terms of how well kids do. They don't necessarily need two parents, but they do need a stable home, and they do need a close connection with a caregiver in order to have the kind of basis in these character strengths to do well in school. And so I think it's a real social problem that all of us need to think about and pay attention to. What I worry about, and I don't think Steve was necessarily saying this, but I think we can push in this direction. We can be pulled in this direction. Is to say, well, okay, if these neighborhoods, if these families are unstable in this particular way, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, this is just a syndrome that is theirs to deal with. Whereas in reality, I think there's lots of evidence, and I talk about some of this evidence in my book, that we can, that the public at large can play a more supportive role in the lives of families and in the lives of young people, even when they're growing up in these difficult circumstances, even when they're surrounded by poverty, that can help to overcome a lot of these problems. It's a big issue. You know, changing the way that a neighborhood like Roseland functions is going to take a long time, and it's going to take a lot of work. But I think there are lots of indications that when we do support kids in these ways and we do support families in these ways, it can lead to some really powerful transformations and can lead to much higher levels of success for the kids who are growing up in those neighborhoods.
Let's go next to Barbara in Urbana. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Yeah, I have two little kids, and they were really ready to go to school when they were 5 years old. But I'm seeing, number one, with the ISATs and the standardized testing, that cognitive skills are being pushed farther and farther back on littler and younger kids. When I went to kindergarten, I was born in the 60s and 1970 when I went to school, kindergarten was socializing, learning your ABCs, your numbers and stuff, and a lot of little kids, especially boys, aren't ready to sit still to learn to read when they're five in kindergarten. So, you know, neurologically, physiologically, they're not ready. So I'm wondering how that, you know, I'm sure that plays into, you know, they get labeled as hyper, ADD, whatever, and plays into their success in school and in life.
All right. Thanks very much for the comment. What do you think?
Well, I think Barbara's right that there are different, you know, different kids learn these skills at different times. And, you know, I don't think that we should be ignoring these skills altogether and saying, oh, you know, kids will learn to read when they learn to read, because I think it is certainly necessary and a good idea to give kids the opportunity, you know, surround them with text, read to them a lot, give them the opportunity to get excited by books and by reading. But I also think that she's absolutely right that when we, you know, feel like there is such a rigid timetable that kids have to develop all these skills by a certain age or they're doomed, what that can lead to is not only does it not really make much of a difference in terms of their skill development, kids do tend to develop at the speed in which they're naturally attuned to, but it also leads to this intense family anxiety. And I think this is actually probably more true among affluent families than among low-income families, that when a family can get kind of overwhelmed with this anxiety of, you know, which tutors do we need to put them in and which therapist do we need to send them to get their, you know, get the right medicine for their ADHD, it can create this this overwhelming anxiety in a family that has a huge effect on kids and sends them the message, you know, that there's something wrong with them, that they are not performing the way they should, that they're falling short. And that stuff actually has a huge effect on kids' development, growing up in that kind of anxious environment with a lot of pressure on them, you know, especially when they're three or four or five, can really have a negative effect on kids.
You write in your book that this is a, quote, particularly anxious moment in the history of American parenting. Are you sure that's not just your impression because you yourself are a recently new parent for the last few years?
No, I'm not sure, and that's a great question. I think there's some way that, you know, parents have always felt these pressures and felt these anxieties, and so it's hard for me to know objectively whether that's true. But I do think that there is evidence out there, you know, like Junior Kumon only started offering their three-year-old classes a couple of years ago. So I do think that there's something new about what's going on right now. There's this extra push, especially in this cognitive dimension, that, you know, in the years before Baby Einstein and Baby Mozart and Junior Kumon wasn't as present in the lives of kids. But you're right. I'm sure that part of it is just my own experience of having a three-year-old and being bombarded with this stuff.
How did that experience impact you as you wrote this book, and how has your research into this book affected then your parenting in turn?
It's interesting. You know, I think when my son was born, I was very much one of these anxious parents caught up in the cognitive hypothesis, believing that it was important to, you know, get all of these skills develop all these skills in him as quickly as possible. But reading this research and doing this reporting, I think, actually had the effect of making me calm down a little bit as a parent. And I think that I am more laid back about the idea of, you know, getting him into the right preschool, getting him to develop these skills as quickly as possible. And I think much more about his character, which is, I know, a weird word to be using for a three-year-old. But I'm convinced by the research that at the very least the underpinnings, the biological and psychological underpinnings of what later becomes these important character strengths are absolutely developing in his first few years of life. And the most helpful and important thing that I can do is to give him the kind of warmth and support and ability to manage stress that is going to help him develop that dimension of skills.
Paul Tough is the parent of a young child. He's also a journalist and author and a longtime contributor to This American Life. His new book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Paul, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Paul Tough in a conversation from October of 2012. On tomorrow's show, we will offer you another opportunity to ask any questions you may have about the care and feeding of your pets. We do these shows every few months with a pair of veterinarians. Whether you own a dog or a cat or a bird or gerbil or guinea pig, turtle, snake, iguana, whatever, we will welcome your questions about the best way to care for the animal companion or companions in your life. That's on tomorrow's program. Then on Monday, we'll discuss political discourse in America with John Murphy, an associate professor of communication here at the University of Illinois. Monday is the 14th anniversary of the beginning of President Bill Clinton's impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. He was the first president to be impeached by the House since Andrew Johnson in 1868, and it was a major political development dissected moment by moment by 24-hour news channels and talk radio. Politicians and pundits alike spoke in ever coarser tones about the issues surrounding the trial, and our political discourse has not exactly improved in the 14 years since. In fact, we saw moments when the major players in the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations just over the last week or two struggled to communicate effectively with one another. We will welcome your questions and comments as we consider what it might take to raise the level of discourse in our politics and whether major issues and ideas can be debated thoughtfully and respectfully by people with wildly divergent views. We'll also explore what led to the coarsening of our political discourse, particularly in the last 20 years, and whether our perception that it was more respectful in the past is really true. That's on Monday's show. Then Tuesday, we will turn our attention to the history of and issues surrounding Illinois' pension debt. We'll talk about how our state found its way into such a massive debt obligation, some of the issues that lawmakers are working through right now in Springfield, and what might ultimately be the best way forward to meet that debt and sustain the state's public pension system. That's on Tuesday's program. Today's show is produced by Travis Stansel. Other members of our focus team are Pam Dempsey, Jim Meadows, and Kimberly Cronick. Our technical director is Kyle Mabry. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we head into the last few hours of trading for this session. Grain and soybean futures are mixed today. Wheat futures have pared their overnight losses amid trader views that recent declines were overdone in the face of the U.S. winter wheat crop threats in the Great Plains with those dry conditions out there. But technical weakness continues to weigh on corn and soybeans. Overnight, we got into the gap around 685 in the March contract in corn and off a big sale, well, cancellation actually, of soybeans, 315,000 metric tons China returning to the U.S. That pushed soybeans down below a long-term uptrend line, and it's fighting back. Soybeans coming off its lows. Let's look at the particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat 814 and a quarter up 3 1/4. July 827 and 3/4 up a half. March wheat in Chicago 756 and a half up 1 1/4. July 772 and a half down a half. March corn 690 and a half down a quarter. May 693 down a half. July 689 and 3/4 down 1. December 587 down 5 1/4. January soybeans 1394 and a half down 11. March 1380 and a quarter down 12. July 1370 and a quarter down 11 3/4. November of 13 at 1283 down 11. January soybean meal 40220 down 490. March $400.80 down 490. January soybean oil 5038 down 14. March 5085 down 20. February live cattle 133.75 up 137. And a half. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.